Welcome to Finding Your Identity, the podcast about helping you find your identity. Welcome back to Finding Your Identity. This is episode 24, and I'm glad that you could be here with me listening to this episode of fun-filled knowledge, brain-enhancing material, which is going to be, you know, as I always say, an interesting thing to listen to, an interesting episode, because this episode is actually going to be about business identity, but not so much business identity directly, but some companies that have essentially pivoted from what they originally were started to, you know, initially start doing business as to what they are today or ended up being if they're no longer in business. But, you know, it's kind of fascinating. I remember this part of college when I was taking business courses that were, you know, where we essentially had to study how businesses work and make decisions. And I really enjoyed doing the case studies where we actually read case studies about companies, and maybe it was about them launching a new product, or maybe it was about a rebranding effort, you know, whatever it was kind of fascinating to see how these companies kind of turn around. A lot of times we got cases that were, you know, given to us by a professor that said, okay, what should they do? What's the right business move here for them? And, you know, the professor essentially gave us, you know, an assignment of kind of dissecting the business and trying to, you know, make sense of it, like figure out what their best move could be and back it up with facts and you know, numbers and whatever. But it always fascinated me when we talked about companies that essentially started as something and then changed to something else, and or, you know, they grew and they found that they kind of reached the top of the sales marker where they really couldn't, you know, sell any more than what they were selling, or, you know, they needed to branch off to make more revenue, to bring in more revenue, and they essentially did something like Arm & Hammer, which, you know, is baking soda, and it was, you know, a baking soda product, like for baking. And then all of a sudden the campaigns were like, oh, stick it in your refrigerator half or a quarter open and it'll get rid of smells. Or then they, you know, put it in toothpaste because it helped with whitening your teeth and cleaning your teeth. So, you know, that's kind of a simple example, but that's how kind of a brand identity kind of transformed. So, you know, that's what this episode is going to be about. And, you know, stay tuned. I think it's going to be interesting. So the first company that I'm going to talk about is one that I think is probably, you know, really well known throughout the world, and probably most people will remember this pivot and this pivot in brand identity that the media kind of took hold of it, I think, and really helped broadcast this shift, because, you know, it kind of sparked some anger in customers. But I'm talking about Netflix, because Netflix, as you remember, was a DVD by mail business, if you remember. I remember. It wasn't that long ago. But, you know, they used to have the DVDs that, you know, you'd go on to the website and you'd pick out which ones you wanted to see. Essentially, you'd specify your queue. And if you had a plan that lets you get three at a time, then you'd, you know, have the next three in your queue would just automatically get mailed to you. And then you'd have, you know, a queue of say like 20 other movies, and they'd, you know, as soon as you sent back whatever movie, you know, one or two of those movies, and the next one or two would get sent out, or you sent all three back, and they used to give you mailers, so they'd come in an envelope, which you just kind of repackage it and throw it back in the mailbox. And, you know, that was Netflix at its origination, you know, so they were, you know, really well known and became really popular for this because it was, you know, kind of a cool idea, and they were different than Blockbuster and big competitor of Blockbuster. And I'll talk about Blockbuster a little bit more specifically after this, but, you know, they essentially were trying to upstage or outpace or outproduce or outsell or whatever you want to call it, anybody that had a brick and mortar store. And they could cut out a lot of overhead purely because they didn't have to have physical locations. You know, they didn't have storefronts. And as you can see in the age of Amazon, how that can make a company a lot of money because they didn't need to have to pay for leasing a building or buying the property, buying the building, and then paying for all the inventory up front to stock all the shelves, pay for employees, you know, electricity, water, all that stuff that you have as overhead with a brick and mortar shop. You know, they didn't have any of that. They had their distribution facilities, and they had, you know, obviously they had to pay employees there, but they could send it all out from one location or two locations in the beginning to all around the country, you know. So it's a good example of how a company kind of started out in one spot and then pivoted, because the Netflix, you know, today is streaming. Now, I believe the video delivery business is still around. I think it's called like DVD.com or something like that. And I think you can still get DVDs, you know, but it's a separate plan. You know, it's actually not included in Netflix, the company, anymore. And if you're a subscriber to Netflix, you could, you know, you can't get physical DVDs anymore, but you can through that company, I think, still get a physical DVD or Blu-rays or whatever. I think probably Blu-rays are popular now, but you could get those delivered to you by mail. Now, Netflix, what made it controversial was, you know, I think it was $7.99 for a subscription. And what made it controversial is they were like, you know, there was a period of time where you were actually getting the streaming and the DVD service for $7.99, or maybe it was $9.99 if you had the three DVDs in the streaming. I forget how it worked out exactly, but they basically said, hey, guess what? We're going to focus on streaming, and it's only going to be $7.99 a month. But if you want DVDs delivered to your house, you're going to actually have to pay us a separate subscription fee and belong to like a different club. And essentially, you know, upset everybody and did this shift by saying, we're not going to support that original business that we started as Netflix, the DVD by mail anymore. We're just going to shift to, you know, internet-based stuff, which, if you think about that, even less overhead in a sense, because now you don't even have to maintain physical copies of DVDs anymore. And, you know, people, like, it's like one server's got this video on it, and it just keeps streaming and streaming, and they're collecting their money, and there's even less overhead. But, you know, they made this decision to make this pivot, and a lot of people were like, that's it, I'm getting rid of Netflix, like, I'm not gonna have this anymore, because, you know, I'm mad. And you know, some people dropped it, and I actually remember, you know, I got rid of it, and I was like, I don't need this, and I got rid of it for a while. I ended up coming back to it a couple years later, you know, because they ended up with a lot more to offer, and, you know, I got into House of Cards, and House of Cards was good, and, you know, they definitely had a lot of, you know, different shows that were appealing. And, you know, needless to say, people adjusted, you know, and then you get another wave of people who are mad when they raise their price by a buck. And, you know, and every time they do that, everyone gets all fired up, says they're going to drop them, you know, and sometimes they lose several thousand people. But, you know, now it's to a state where they've got so many users, it's I mean, it'll have a hurt. It can hurt their bottom line. Obviously, like their stock price will take a hit and whatnot. But I think the company is surviving. What they have to worry about now, obviously, is you got Disney, you got Hulu, you've got ABC, I think, and Fox. I mean, all these companies who are going to start doing streaming services. Now they got to really, or Apple, I think, is the other one, right? So now they got to really watch out, or it'll be interesting to see how it turns out, because now it's going to be a problem. You know, now they've got like real competitors, and they hadn't for a real long time. You know, Hulu kind of feels like had fits and starts. Like they kind of were good. I had them for a little bit, but then it was lame because I was paying pretty much the same price I was paying for Netflix, but had to watch stupid commercials. And so, you know, I think I maintained them for like a year and then got rid of it because it just kind of was ridiculous. So anyways, you know, it was just kind of an interesting one I wanted to start off with, a company that made a pivot and they did it successfully. Another company that had somewhat had to shift its identity, it was Nintendo. And, you know, this is the Nintendo way before most people's time, most people probably listening, because I don't think anyone who's listening is from the 1800s, you know, 1880. If they are, please let me know, because that would be just fantastic to talk to you. But, you know, way before our time, you know, Nintendo was actually a playing card company, and it kind of started off that way, and playing cards were huge back in that era. And, you know, it was one of those things that they could only make so much. And like a lot of businesses, you know, the businesses that last, they figure out how to make that pivot and how to change their identity in a way that's going to keep them alive and help sustain them. So, you know, they actually ended up becoming a company that dabbled in, you know, being a taxi company, doing instant rice, hourly hotels. And, you know, it really wasn't until they kind of found themselves in the video game industry that's when, you know, they kind of found their footing, you know, and, you know, they kind of could recognize that video games were going to all of a sudden be popular, and they kind of jumped on, because, you know, you got to remember that, you know, it was 60s, 70s when it was kind of starting to figure out, you know, the people were starting to figure out how they could make video games and, you know, mass produce them. And, you know, they obviously, like, a big factor at the time was arcades, because arcades were like super popular, you know. So they were able to kind of take advantage of getting into that area. And, you know, the early 70s is when they actually you know, worked it out with another company to create a game console. And when they kind of got a taste of it and they found that they could make it, they decided they were going to make a game console. And it was in 1977 that they actually made their first game console. And they actually then, you know, went on to make it, you know, super popular. Obviously, Nintendo, the original Nintendo, was a mega hit. And then Mario, the little plumber, you know, became just the mascot for the whole company. And it's kind of a cool story. And, you know, I think it's interesting when you start to think of the fact that they started off playing cards, which is in the realm of games, right? But to then end up being, you know, this mega company that's, they made Nintendo and Super Nintendo, had this lull, you know, they kind of disappeared, you know, then they sprang back up with the Wii. It was like the Wii became popular. They also had, you know, the handheld consoles. Game Boys were super popular. I mean, they had some deeply seated fan bases, still have, you know, with the Game Boy, and then they ended up with the Nintendo DS and 2D, 3DS, all those different little handheld consoles. And then the Switch, which was just like another mega hit. And they keep making the right moves. And, you know, they stick around just because they kind of figured out the scheme. And in video games is that area that they need to, you know, focus on. You know, and there's also, like, if you really look into the history of it, a lot of it had to do with how they controlled every aspect of how they produced games. You know, they created a console. They had really tight contracts with the game developers, and the game developers had to hand over like a lot of money and could only, you know, basically use the parts that Nintendo sold to them in order to create the things, the cartridges. So Nintendo kind of worked out a lot of that and figured out how to make a lot of money. And, you know, they're still a mega company. There's a little sticky, not so sticky, squishy, maybe that's a better word, squishy little toy thingy that you might have heard of before, which is Play-Doh. And, you know, I always think that stuff ends up getting stuck in all the weirdest places on tables. And, you know, it's kind of salty. You don't want to eat it. Not that I would know firsthand or anything, but, you know, when you have kids, you kind of find stuff out. And when they make you a little squashed up Play-Doh cookie and they're like, come on, eat this, daddy. And you're like, all right. And they're like, no, really, take a bite of it. And you're like, oh, come on. Okay, fine. And so you pretend to take a bite, but can't help but get the little salty taste in your mouth. Then you've experienced life, really experienced it. But Play-Doh is kind of interesting because Play-Doh actually, you know, was originally this product that was used to clean black residue that coal heaters left on walls. So, you know, back in the early 1900s, that was kind of a problem because coal is just really dirty. I mean, coal's dirty because of the dust, and it's hard to avoid it. And so when you had a coal heater, it just naturally would leave dust all around the walls and stuff. So they created it as this method of essentially wiping, you know, or scrubbing down a wall to basically get off that dust. And it's kind of fascinating to me how it was just happened to be some, you know, some family member to the owners had the stuff and had a bunch of it, you know, probably laying around they got for free and was actually using it in their classroom with their kids, like young kids, like kindergartners. They started playing with it and making shapes in it and the way it was molding. And then all of a sudden it was like, hey, guess what? This is a $1 billion idea right here. This is a kid's toy. So that's how Play-Doh kind of got its start. And it's kind of another one of those interesting stories. And, you know, a lot of it comes down to the company's founders, owners, or managers or whatever, just having enough foresight to see that they need to make that kind of pivot. And then they do, and they ended up becoming wildly successful. And, you know, these are the good examples of them finding their identities or pivoting to, you know, reinvent their identities. If you happen to grow up during the boom of cell phones, you know, the point in time when they essentially became so affordable that the masses could just get them, you know, and to the point where everybody and their brother seemed to be making cell phones, all these companies. And you remember that time was just kind of a crazy time and there was a lot of options. And then you had a company like Nokia. I remember listening to an episode of Tech Stuff about Nokia. And I think Jonathan Strickland, the host, was kind of talking about how you're supposed to pronounce it. I can't remember how you're supposed to, but I think he said Nokia. But anyways, I'm going to say Nokia. And, you know, I knew it as Nokia. Whatever. Nokia. I'm going to say whatever I'm going to say. You're going to listen, right? No. I'm not going to force you to do anything you don't want to do. So chillax. But Nokia was so crazy popular, and partly because you could buy these phones and they were kind of like cheap throwaway phones in a sense, but of course you wouldn't want to throw it away or let anything happen to your precious phone. But they came with crazy accessories. You had all different types of cases. You had faces that you could swap on, you know. I mean, this is probably like a couple generations after Nokia started making their phones and mass producing them, and they became wildly popular. But it was just like, you know, all of a sudden all these phones just were able to have their own identities. Like you could, you know, spread your own identity to your phone. You know, if you were like a hunter or something, you could have a camouflage phone. Or if you were, you know, like big into the anime cartoons, you could have anime cartoons that were somehow their faces were put on the cases. Or if you were big into Nintendo and you loved Mario, you could have a case that had Mario on it. You know, there was just endless possibilities. Bedazzled looking ones with little fake jewels. You know, I remember there was like a gold Nokia phone, and then they had the kinds that were, you know, the slide down cover, exposed the keypads, and just tons and tons of options, you know. So just one of those companies that just kind of became super well known to the masses. And what seemed like came out of nowhere, you know, like you'd think, oh, this company, if you were to guess, oh, when did Nokia get its start? You'd probably think, oh, maybe like the 90s, you know, but it actually was 1865. Now, to me, it's a little misleading to say that, but it's actually true, because that's how it got started, as a paper mill, you know, where they actually made paper. And it kind of got that start, and the guy who founded it, you know, opened up another mill and then essentially wanted to be opportunistic and entrepreneurial and decided he wanted to get into other goods and started, you know, getting into the rubber goods industry, electronics, telecommunication devices, and, you know, basically went almost a century, right? Because they started in 1865, more than a century. They got to the 1990s, and they started a, you know, they made a phone, and then they just kept reiterating, and they eventually hit on some super popular devices that really became like the kind of pinnacle representation of early cell phones. And so, you know, it's just another example of a company that pivoted and did it successfully. You know, I mean, you'll sense a theme here, because you really, if you want to be good in business, you can't be what they call myopic, which, you know, is one of those fun terms from business school. But, you know, like the railroads were very myopic because they didn't think that anything else needed to exist other than themselves. And, you know, essentially got blindsided by airlines as a mode of transportation or, you know, a delivery vehicle. So a company could easily just get in its own way by just not seeing the future as clearly as some other companies. But then you have, you know, a company like Nokia that clearly the business, the person running the business saw that there was more, you know, there was a lot more that they could do to make money. And a lot of times it's like these companies really just need to become, you know, venture capitalist type companies or investment firms, or, you know, they get enough money from their initial business venture that they then can go and invest in other types of businesses. So, you know, a lot of times it's that, you know, sometimes it's because they're fighting for their life. You know, they like Sears tried and tried again to try to reinvent itself. And, you know, I mean, it's another good example, because Sears Roebuck, they started as a catalog. Now, their underlying concept is, you know, selling consumer goods, never really changed, but the method that they did changed, right? So they sold through catalogs, mail order. So, it was a Sears Roebuck mail order catalog that was sent out around the country and people got, and you could see there's bicycles, there's ski boots or, jackets. They had everything, tools. And so a lot of people were essentially, at the time, exposed to products that weren't made locally. So they really got to actually look in a catalog and have such a wider variety of options to buy whatever they needed, right? And then that's kind of how they got their start. And then, brick and mortar stores came after that. And then Walmart came around and they started crushing the stores like Caldor. Remember Caldor? Caldor was around till it wasn't anymore. And the Kmart, kind of declined. But incidentally, Sears ended up buying Kmart and trying to help it survive. But Walmart's methods have made them what they are, and they maintain what they are, And then you got an Amazon that comes around and just does it a little bit differently and a little bit better. And, they're not killing Walmart. But they're definitely hurting it, I mean, I don't know. you look at all these companies and you have to imagine, like, well, what's the next Walmart and what's the next Amazon, down the road? Because they come and go. I mean, there's companies that have been around for a couple hundred years, definitely. But then there's companies that, like a Circuit City was Best Buy's competitor. I don't know how long that was around, but I can remember when it went out of business. And it was really, I think, a shock in a sense to some people, but just a sign of the times. There was also some, like, I think, corruption and stuff like that. But still, I mean, you'd think that somebody could come around and pick it up, another company or investment firm or something. But, that didn't happen. It kind of died off. I think there's the Circuit City website actually still lived on for a while. It might even still be around. And it was like owned by like Toys R Us or something. I don't know. So someone else basically managed it because, again, websites don't have a lot of overhead. So very doable, very doable to kind of to live on in another form like that. So some of you may have actually used Groupon before. Groupon's that the whole point of the site is local deals, or deals that, that essentially the masses help to unlock the discount. Multiple people got together, like a group buying type of thing where, you get enough people to buy it and it drives the price down because, when you buy stuff in bulk, when a company buys stuff in bulk, it ends up should cost the company less to purchase it because it's kind of like you get bulk discounts and whatnot. But what's interesting about Groupon is it actually, it started as a Kickstarter type company where, it was a fundraising site, but it was for like fundraising from what the traditional fundraising was, where it's, fundraising because they're trying to raise money for some kind of cause, like a social cause, like, helping get socks to the homeless or coats to the homeless or, get coats to children who are unfortunate enough to not have coats or whatever it is. Like, you could kind of create causes. And it had a Kickstarter. If you don't know what Kickstarter is, Kickstarter is this company that essentially says, you go on it and you say, I need to raise $10,000, and I need $10,000 because I want to create this product, and here's the product, and this is everything that the product's going to do, and I want to be able to live my dream and make this business a reality. And so I'm looking for, $10,000 to get off the ground, and I'll give you a little reward. I'll give you the product if you bid, if you help me fund this by giving me $100, like, you'll get the product plus a sticker that says you're awesome or whatever, right? So that's Kickstarter. Same concept with Groupon, except, wasn't necessarily anything you could walk away without a warm feeling in your heart, right? So they had this kind of going, and it was kind of like, all right, so it's only going to be funded if enough people believe in the cause and actually contribute, you know. So you get the $10,000 to get socks to the homeless, and that will get funded. You only get $9,999. Sorry. Unfortunately, the homeless don't get socks today. But that was kind of the concept. And the founder was actually trying to spin off that same concept with products and doing the group buying, and essentially, hey, if enough people show interest in buying this product, then the discount will get, you know, unlocked, and then everybody will get the product at that discounted price. Again, that group buying concept. And so that's how Groupon got started, because that ended up becoming the more popular of the two types of sites, and kind of just knocked the tipping point, or the point, I think it was called. That point site or business basically just kind of faded off, and Groupon became the business model. You know, Groupon's a little annoying sometimes because there's a lot of restrictions you have to deal with. You know, it's like, okay, like you can get this spa treatment and it's going to be $50. Normally it's $100, but when you go in there, you have to go in there on a Tuesday between 10 a.m. and 10:01 a.m. and you have to go in there and you have to compliment everybody in there and say one nice thing about everybody who's in there in that spa. And you know, you have to bring them some coffee from Dunkin' Donuts or tea, whatever they like, and a box of donuts. And you know, you have to make sure you fill their tip jar with at least $20. And those are all the restrictions for you to get this deal. No big deal, right? But it is a big deal sometimes when there's really no value, especially with the blackout dates and all that nonsense. So there are still some things that work, you know, like sometimes you'll find escape room discounts or something like that. And those are good gifts for people. But, you know, otherwise, like, I don't know, maybe it's just the spa stuff or nail stuff that some tends to be too restrictive to make it worth it. And sometimes the products are a little sketchy. Like I've seen deals where I'm like, hey, look at that. It's showing up that this laptop or Chromebook or whatever, you know, is only $150. Normally it's $200. You know, that's a good deal. But then you like look and you read it and it's like, oh, well, this is refurbished. And then, and this is the discontinued model. And, you know, you just got to be careful. Like maybe there's a good deal out there. Just be careful. Buyer beware. So Groupon, kind of check off the list, is another one maybe you'd be, you know, surprised to know about or something. But yeah, now another one, which is another company, which is crazy popular and probably little known, but Twitter actually was this company called Odeo, O-D-E-O, and it actually was somewhat of a search engine to help people subscribe and find podcasts, incidentally, you know, but kind of seeing the writing on the wall with iTunes kind of creeping into that market. And then what iTunes ended up becoming, Twitter ended up kind of pivoting to what the company said, listen, we're in trouble. We got 2 weeks to figure out what to do. I'm not even joking. It was like, we got 2 weeks or everyone's out of a job. So somebody think of something quick. And they did. It was actually, you know, Jack Dorsey and Biz Stone, who were, you know, the founders. And they had this idea. And, you know, Jack Dorsey, I think he is still the CEO. He's been on and off as CEO for a while. But they conceived this idea, said, let's make a microblogging status update program/platform for sharing with the world. And look at it, look how it kind of blew up and became this huge thing. And that was the pivot, you know, and not even really related in technology. I mean, we went from search engine that kind of just knew about podcasts to a social media platform that's really kind of changed the way people find out about information, find out about news, talk to each other, rant about things to each other, you know, expose crazy stories or crazy people. You know, it's just, it's kind of fascinating that that's how they kind of pivoted and you know, how they started off in that one direction. And then all of a sudden it was just like, you know what? We got 2 weeks. Somebody better think of something or we're all screwed. That's just hilarious to me. But when I was at Web Loyalty, there was a similar conversation that happened when Web Loyalty started going down the toilet, because it was like, we need to think of something to make money because what we've been doing seems to be a little illegal. So we better figure something out. And they did not figure anything out. Their pivot was to sell off and kind of be absorbed by a bigger company of scammers and just kind of blend in amongst the other scammers, because they were direct marketing scammers and not internet scammers, but, you know, basically just disappeared, vanished, which is incredibly challenging to overcome when you need to place a company that's disappeared on your work history and there's nobody to contact. And you're like, I swear I worked there. I remember it very clearly, but they're like, well, this company doesn't exist. It's like, yeah, it doesn't exist anymore. Do you want me to tell you the story of why? But I digress. That's just nuts. Nutso stuff. If you've ever been to a Walmart, you've seen a sign for Western Union. That's a weird segue. But sometimes you'd see the yellow, it's a very distinct yellow Western Union sign. And you'll see it as a way to send money. And I don't know if you've ever used it. I honestly can't remember if I've ever used it. I may have used it once. It's always been associated with scammers. It's always been the way that the prince needs your help to save his country by just forwarding him or wiring him through Western Union $5,000. You know, it seems to be the choice of princes all over the world who happen to know your email address, little OU. But Western Union, you know, it actually started as a telegram service, and, you know, it kind of came to popularity, and that was early 1900s. And 200 million telegrams was the peak amount that they sent in 1929. And, you know, that was before the telephone. And it's, you know, the original communication method, you know, sending a telegram for Mr. So-and-so. And he was like, why do you call me Mr. So-and-so? You know, my name is Charles. What the heck? But, you know, it's just kind of an interesting thing, because it's just one of those outdated and old school methods of communication that you tend to kind of not think about anymore, or maybe don't even know about. And telegrams were just that was the way to communicate. And then telephones came around, and you could pick up and you can just have a conversation, you know, because the telegram was kind of like, you'd send it to a telegram office, from one telegram office to another telegram office, and then it would be there until you went physically to that place to get to receive the message, or somebody went and got you if you were in town or something like that. But, you know, there was really no way to know you got a telegram if you were out somewhere, you know, until you went to the telegram office. But, you know, then, like, if you were at your house and the telegram office was in town and, you know, you were 10-minute horseback ride or something from the telegram office, and maybe once a week you'd go in there and find out about the telegram. If it was important, maybe they'd send somebody out on a horse to your house to warn you that, you know, the redcoats are coming or something. But I mean, that was way, way, way earlier. Yeah, what am I thinking? Nobody, Paul Revere didn't use a telegram. He just shouted and used a lantern. But, you know, Western Union was stuck, basically, because telephones would essentially cause them to go extinct. And they figured out that they could get into the business of transferring money, you know, and becoming a method of exchanging money over different, you know, distances. And so they kind of made that pivot And now, you know, that's the way that you know them, as a popular MoneyGram service or whatever you want to call it. I think they call them MoneyGrams, but kind of as a throwback to the Telegram. But that's how you can kind of send money overseas to somebody if they need it. Don't send money to the prince of Gajanjuanj, okay? It's a scam. Just trying to let you know. And in this day and age, actually, what's interesting about Western Union is that it's, again, going to have to find itself trying to pivot and figure something else out, because, you know, there's other things that are really starting to supplant it. And, you know, I think that's a common problem. Again, like Netflix, who's got to, like, worry about Disney Plus or Apple Plus or whatever the heck Plus, which I'm sure someone's working on that. But another interesting little tidbit there for ya. And I think there's one more, which I think I'm going to share with you. If you're good. Okay, I made you wait long enough, which was probably not long enough. But anyways, I'm just going to give you something crappy then. You were just expecting something fantastic because I said if you're good, you're going to get something? Well, joke's on you, isn't it? Now, maybe. I don't know. I'm just, maybe I'll just take a quick nap, because I feel like I'm just leaving you in suspense now, because you're like, what is he going to say? What the heck is he? Just say it. Why isn't he not saying it? Why is he just saying what he's saying right now and not saying the thing he said he was going to say? I've been here and I've been so good. Anyways, a little bit of the crazy came out, didn't it? Okay, so it's because I was like flipping through my little notes that I had right here. Now, what started as a small antique shop in London back in the 1830s was what nobody would realize going to be the largest and most richest energy company in the world, known as Shell. Shell-la-la-la. You know, they got a gas station. Maybe you've seen it before. Shell. And it's kind of funny because that's a kind of crazy pivot. If you think about it, like, you're selling antiques one day and then you're spilling oil in the Gulf of Mexico. Wait, no, sorry. That probably didn't happen. You're spilling oil in Alaska, maybe? I don't know. I think all the oil companies have spilled a little bit somewhere at some time. It's fine. Just use some Dawn on the freaking little ducks, because it makes for a cute commercial. But I'm not trying to be insensitive to ducks. I do like ducks, so enough with the hate mail, okay? But yeah, so Shell was a little antique shop, and, you know, the guys who were running it, they just kind of broadened their horizons and kept building out their business venture as they made money. They found more opportunities, and, you know, that's what entrepreneurs do, and it's what they did. And they kind of got wind of a boom in oil that was coming, and they were able to produce a tanker that was more efficient for transporting oil. And that's how they got into it. I mean, they really didn't blow up to be super large until they merged with this other company called the Royal Dutch Petroleum Company, which, you know, in the early 20th century, when they merged, you know, they just became the powerhouse in the oil industry. And, you know, from then on, it was just, you know, skyrocketing until they became the super gazillion dollar company that they are now, you know. And there's gas stations all over the place. You get Shell gas stations all over the place, and you see their distinct Shell. And are they the Supremium where I just saw a commercial for Mr. Supremium because he wears his ascot wears an ascot or something like that. But I don't know. Maybe I'm imagining it. Maybe the smell of oil made me a little dizzy and crazy. But anyways, that's all I want to talk about because that's a lot of stuff I said. But I hope you enjoyed this episode of Finding Your Identity. That was about businesses that change their identities in order to stay alive and stay in business. And, you know, it's kind of a fascinating subject. You could look more into it. You could look at companies like Colgate and, you know, Arm & Hammer. And what was that other one? What was it called? The 20 Mule Borax or something like that. Like that was kind of an interesting one as well, because, you know, borax is kind of this crazy, I think toxic, somewhat toxic chemical, but not, like, I guess if you ingest it, it's harmful, but what isn't, you know, these days. But all I know is it's used to make slime, homemade slime, and it's really messy. So I know much about it, more than I really want to, but, you know, it's another company that pivoted. You can look it up because I don't feel like talking about it. Just don't want to. But, you know, there's a lot on the internet that you could go look up. You could go look at this one company that was called Google, and where you used to go and search for things on it, and then now it's just listening to you and watching you and, you know, reading your mind and mining it, storing that mind data in databases and selling it to Saudi Arabia or something. But hope you enjoyed this episode, and I'm going to go check on the non-listeners because I found another tactic that seems to be working. It's called making them listen to it over and over. Just the first episode, the worst episode, making them listen to it over and over. That's what you get for not listening. Although, oh, wait a second. Because once I play it for them, I have to release them because they're no longer non-listeners. Oh, darn it. All right, I guess I got to go deal with that. Until next time, this is Finding Your Identity.